Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. Music there from Adrian Crowley, and we'll discover later if it's Crowley or Crowley. We've been talking about this for a long time on this programme, but Adrian is my guest tonight. Every Sunday night on Mystery Train, we get someone in to pick the tunes, and tonight it is Adrian Crowley? Crowley.
Well, I say Crowley.
Well, Crowley it is from here on in. So it's good to have you here. You're kind of a hard man to get because the last time we sent out signals for you, you were in New York. How long ago was that? That's not that long ago, is it?
Actually, I've been in New York every year for the last 3 years, around the same time of the year.
The last time you were there was with a movie score.
Yeah, that's right. That was just a few weeks ago. I went over with four other lads, one being Barry Adamson from many bands, The Bad Seeds, Barry Adamson himself.
He's got a new compilation album just out.
Spanning 40 years of his career.
The title's called Memento Mori, which is a sort of a signal.
Ah, yes.
So Barry, who else? Barry Adamson and who else?
Sean McRae, who you know well. Yeah. Kevin Murphy, who you know well, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Matthew Nolan.
Very good. And you played live score to, what was the movie?
Yes, it's a movie called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, by an Irish director called Rex Ingram. It was made back in the 20s. Mm. And he was actually born in Rathmines and moved to Hollywood, made his name there, and then was kind of forgotten in the history of film.
So this was happening at the Lincoln Center, wasn't it? Which is quite a prestigious venue.
Absolutely. Yes, it was part of the New York Film Festival. And the room we played in it's the Walter Reed Theatre, which is used by the Film Society of New York. And interestingly enough, Martin Scorsese lent us his print of the film to use for the gig. Isn't that kind of cool?
He knows his movie history, but he's an interest in the Irish side of it.
Yes,
particularly has John Ford and all the rest of it.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
so there you go. Marty didn't show up, did he?
No, he did send some of his staff there.
He sent other people to watch it for him. Yeah. We'll all do that in the future. So anyway, that's why you weren't here last week or 3 weeks ago. You're in New York playing live. Did you enjoy that? What does that feel like as a musician? What do you have to do? Are you watching the film or is someone else sort of conducting you or what?
Well, actually no one conducts us when we do this. This was our third time performing the piece. The first time was in St. Patrick's Cathedral for St. Patrick's Festival last year. And it was very unusual for me. I'd never really done anything like that before. We all got together in a room and basically wrote the score together. And everyone seemed to have a little riff or whatever that they thought might work. But we came up with everything in a short space of time and rehearsed with the film there in front of us. You know, we'd pause all the time and talk about what we're going to do next. We had an idea of the emotional impact of, well, the entire film and what where not to play and where we thought we should cut loose a bit. And then live, actually, New York was the first time where we didn't have a monitor to look at, because usually we'd have a little onstage monitor, so we wouldn't be craning our necks around the big screen. Mm. But in New York, we had just the big screen. And it was very surreal. I felt we were inside the film, you know. And I think we all went into a trance at some stage, which, you know, you can easily miss a cue if you go into that state of mind. But
you kind of think of those guys in the old days, they had to play the organ live to horror movies. And
what a job.
Yeah. Well, a job's a job. We played a track just at the top of the programme. I don't know if I credited it or not, from the album Dark Eyed Messenger, your most recent album, a song called The Wish. And we'll maybe play something else from you as the night goes on. But you're here tonight to pick your own choices of music, Adrian.
Yes.
And your first choice is Robert Wyatt. Is that what you want to go first?
Yes, exactly. Sea Song by Robert Wyatt.
Now tell me about Robert Wyatt. I've interviewed him. He's a fascinating man. But why, yeah. what appeals to you most about Robert Wyatt?
Well, his sweetness, his beauty is he's got something very special. He's got humor, and he just breaks my heart. You know, I've never met him. I just think of him as some kind of uncle figure.
And that, were you aware of him? Because I think I knew his music before I realized anything about Soft Machine and his history and all of that.
Yeah. I when I first heard him, I didn't know about Soft Machine. I had vaguely heard of them, I suppose.
Yeah.
Then I discovered he played drums with them. And yeah, he's got so many beautiful records. I discovered them, I don't know how long ago, 25 years ago or something. And this song is from an album that was re-released by Domino a number of years ago called Rock Bottom.
Mm-hmm. And this, which one was Sea Song, that's the opening song on this album, isn't it? So Sea Song from Robert Wyatt. And that's Sea Song from Robert Wyatt from the album Rock Bottom. The first choice tonight of Adrian Crowley, who's with me in studio picking all the tracks. You can tell from that something about Adrian's own aesthetic there. That's not a 3-minute hit wonder, is it?
Goes against any idea of convention.
The word sprawling sounds like it's something wrong with that. It's not sprawling, but it's a complex, well put together thing.
Absolutely. And just when you think the song is ending, you know, you're coming into what you assume is the outro, it just goes on and on and keeps meandering and swimming away. I suppose maybe that's what it was reference to.
And you mentioned there while it was playing that you discovered that Bowie was that was his favorite song.
Yeah, I only discovered that 2 years ago. I was thrilled, you know. You know the kind of stuff that happens. You go down a foxhole on YouTube and discover these weird old interviews transferred from VHS, and there was an interview with him in a hotel room, and he was answering questions that fans had put to him by letter, you know.
Right.
So he's reading out the questions from pieces of paper, and one of them was, "What's your favorite song?" And he said, "Sea Song by Robert Wyatt," and I liked him even more after that. Bowie, that is, and I love Bowie.
Terrific. So, Adrian, where are you from? Because this is complicated.
It is, actually.
Well, maybe not in your head, but it was to me when I tried to figure it out.
Well, for a start, John, the very question I find very difficult to answer. The question when someone puts to you in passing, they say, "Where are you from?" I really don't know how to answer that question a lot of the time. Does that mean where I live now, North Strand, or where I grew up, mostly Galway? Or where I was born, Malta.
How did that come about? Because even though Malta is relatively close to us, I don't really know much about Malta. I suspect, unless you've been there on holidays, it's a bit of a mystery to most of us.
It is. It's an independent country, has its own language. Well, the reason why I was born there is my mother is Maltese.
Right.
And before I was born, the family lived in West Africa, in Sierra Leone. And
Family or your dad's family?
Well, the family that I'm from. Oh, my father and my older siblings.
So it is
my family where I'm from. Yes.
So what were they doing in Sierra Leone?
Well, my father is an engineer. He's retired now. A structural engineer, and he worked for a Scottish firm, and they worked. He had jobs in Libya and West Africa, working on road infrastructure, structural engineering.
Right.
And his work brought him around.
Right.
And my mother was living in just outside Benghazi in Libya when they met. They met in a sandstorm.
Right.
Yeah. And my mother's story is just so incredible. She wrote a book about her early life. And that's in there.
What's it called?
It's called Beyond the Ghibli.
Beyond the Ghibli. And what's her name, by the way?
Her name is Vicky Crowley.
Vicky Crowley, Beyond the Ghibli. I must check that out. Do any of these aspects of that background impact on you? I mean, do you feel that you're in any way Maltese or, you know?
Yes, I do. It's funny, though. I never really know. I mean, I was back in Malta recently with my family, and I felt really at home in certain parts. In Valletta, for instance, one afternoon I went walking through the streets, and I was taking photographs, and I found I was in this really calm state. It was just amazing. Like I felt I somehow belonged, or some part of me belonged to that street. And then I looked up at the sign, the street sign, and it was a street where my great-grandfather and grandfather grew up, you know?
Wow.
And I get the same feeling, though, in the west of Ireland. But growing up, I never really could tell you, you know, where I really did belong. I still don't really
It's
know.
Interesting what you say, because normally, you know, you ask somebody where they're from, they'll tell you they're from Mayo or they're from Dublin or whatever it is. And you don't think that for some people that is actually a complicated question.
It is, yeah. Yeah, I didn't really feel like I was in an especially Irish household, you know. What with all the travelling we were always doing, and also all my siblings. At one point we were all from different countries, born in different countries.
Really?
See, I said from.
You were born in different countries. And what language is spoken in the house then?
Oh, at home was always English.
Yeah. But your mother obviously spoke Maltese.
Oh, yes.
And did she speak Maltese to you?
I'd pick it up. Her mum would often visit, and they'd only converse in Maltese. Mm. And her sister and brothers, they spoke in Maltese all the time. And so I picked up phrases, and I really wanted to learn. I suppose my mother said, "Well, you know, you don't really need it, do you? You're going to school in Salt Hill and Galway."
If you find yourself in Valletta and you suddenly get this feeling and you realise you're on the street your great-grandfather lived, maybe you should know Maltese as
Well.
You know?
And when I'm there, everyone assumes I am Maltese and I've never left the island.
Yeah.
People speak to me
in Maltese. What about things like food and music and so on in the house? Did your mother bring much of that with her from Malta?
Yeah, good question. Well, food-wise, it was very much Mediterranean-infused food that we ate.
Oh, sounds great.
Yeah, and lots of pasta, lots of homemade pizzas, lots of... there's a dish called timpana, which I love, always have loved, and capers, which is a very Maltese thing, and confectionery that my grandmother would bring over called helwata tork. My grandmother would just open up her suitcase and about 50 packets of those would fall out, and, you know.
Good days.
Yeah.
Good days. Wild as the Wind from Nina Simone, choice of Adrian Crowley, who's with me in studio tonight picking all the tracks. So Adrian, when you first started to find music that kind of you really, let's skip through the usual kind of I heard such and such on Top of the Pops or whatever it was, but let's get to the point where you're actually you know, you want to kind of buy your own records, or you want to own your own records, and you find people that are yours.
Yeah. Well, actually, it started off with cassettes that my sister Deborah used to make from the radio. And I would get these songs into my head. I'd get the cassette into my Walkman and play it. A lot of the time not knowing what the songs were.
Mm.
And so I'd confuse things all the time, you know. And by the time I was in, say, Intersert, I didn't know what a compilation album was. I had no idea.
Mm.
I was a real loner anyway. And so it was really when I came to Dublin to go to college.
And then what happened to your musical journey?
Well, I was studying something that I was working hard on, but I didn't really love. And
which is what?
Architecture.
Right.
And...
Well, you need to be committed to that, all right? It's
absolutely.
A long course.
Yeah. And, you know, I worked and worked at it, but I wasn't happy. And I had a guitar with me that I borrowed from my younger brother. And I started writing songs in my flat. And I had friends... who were in like Dublin guitar bands, and I used to go to the Bagot Inn and McGonagall's and the Underground, the White Horse, all these different places. Later on, the Funnel, just saw hundreds and hundreds of gigs. Oh yeah, and then eventually Whelan's. Mm-hmm. Still I was just picking things up as I went along, and a song would stick in my head, like say, "The White Lady Loves You More" by Elliott Smith, for instance, and I would just obsess over that song for months and months and months. I'd obsess over songs and single albums, and I'd just try and figure out what it was. What is this that is making me feel this way? What is it?
Yeah, because I was just about to ask you there, when you say you obsess over a song for months on end, are you obsessing over the emotions in the song, or are you obsessing over how it was put together?
Well, the mystery behind the song the story of the singer not knowing anything about their life, that's a big thing. And I imagined always where that must have come from, the story of the song or the magic between the notes, the words and everything. That kind of strange, amorphous quality that badly copied music has, and you don't really understand what is making the sounds and what, you know, how it actually managed to get recorded, you know, in what seems like this kind of just a moment captured at the right time. And I think at the time I was wondering, I was already being seduced by the idea of making a record without ever really thinking I would ever make a record, you know?
Let me come back to that about making a record, because given what you've just described, it sounds like you haven't really, you didn't go through the normal sort of situation of a bunch of kids meet up at school and they form a band and they want to do a gig or they want to show off to the girls or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah,
that sort of story doesn't seem to have been yours at all.
No. Like, I don't mean to go on and on and say that how much of a loner I was, but many, many songwriters and solo artists that I know, they come from, you know, an earlier history of being in bands. I never was. I never used to go into a room with like teenage friends and bash it out on an old drum kit. I never did that. Later on I did in my 20s when I would try and get a band together for my own songs, and we'd go into rehearsal studios, but that was something else. I was paying for a rehearsal studio. It wasn't the same as going to someone's house on a Saturday morning or something and, you know, just making noise.
The one question I haven't asked you, which I should have, is when did you first pick up a guitar? I mean, when did that become a possibility for you?
I was in secondary school. There was a guitar at home, and I would just secretly play.
Yeah.
Not like it was against the law or anything. It's just that I was so shy about my music, and I get sort of shakes. You know, my hands would start shaking when I managed to put two chords together or three chords together and pick out a melody, I'd get this unbelievable rush, and I took that as some kind of sign, you know.
Your next musical choice, and there's plenty more to talk about, and this guy will set it up, I'm sure, what we could talk about after this. You want to play a track by Lou Reed?
I love this song, and I only just discovered it 3 years ago, Vanishing Act, and it's words by Edgar Allan Poe.
And that's Vanishing Act from Lou Reed. The choice of Adrian Crowley is with me in studio. It is gorgeous, that, isn't it?
I love it so much.
It really is. And again, I can see with, you know, the music that you're choosing, you know, there's this aesthetic that you have, which we can maybe talk about it a little bit later on when you get to know me better.
Yeah.
But okay. just to come back on what you were saying there, you've probably answered this question already, because you did describe, you know, what it was like when you found you put a couple of chords together and you got this physical kind of rush and thrill of actually composing something that you felt was on the way to somewhere. But I'm kind of curious, though, and Lou Reed is another example of it. Lou Reed began as a poet.
Yeah.
And, you know, he became a songwriter for purely professional reasons. I mean, he was writing kind of songs for Pickwick and, you know,
that's right, yeah.
Advertisements and stuff like that. But, you know, the poetic impulse is there. So I'm wondering, you know, given that you were a loner and, you know, and all these shy about your work and all this kind of stuff, why not just, you know, write poems?
Good question. And, you know, I suppose many teenagers scrawl overwrought lines into the backs of copybooks, and I did. And but it was songs that really held this kind of unreal, unnatural, unworldly, otherworldly mysticism for me. Poetry did as well. But to me, music was more mysterious. Mm-hmm. I never really wanted to fully understand it, you know, what makes a song. But now, I'm 50 now, and I've been looking back where what I've done up to now and where I want to go. And I've been looking at my notebooks again, thinking, did I write this? What is this? It's not a song. Is this the start of a book? Could this be a poem? So it all blurred together, and it still does. But I would like to maybe see if I can gather up all the things that aren't songs and put them in between two covers.
Yeah. What other songwriters attracted you then?
Was it brilliant lyricists?
Were it the obvious ones, if you know what I
mean?
Yeah,
the obvious ones. Yeah. Like the ones that were on those cassettes.
Yeah.
That I still love, you know, like Leonard Cohen. And part of me doesn't want to mention Leonard Cohen because so many people tell me, oh, you're obviously influenced by Len Laughing Boy Cohen. Well, yeah, maybe I am, but...
But there was another whole other generation of people then as well, you know, like Bill Callahan and well, you mentioned Elliott Smith as well. But Bill Callahan in particular, actually, is probably the closest to what you do. And there may be others, that's why I'm asking, I guess, whether other people.
Yeah, and I think I have all his albums, actually. Mm. And I think he is, well, I was going to say underrated. I don't think he is that underrated now, but I would consider him as possibly the best songwriter in the world now.
See, it's just that that generation will never attain the status of Cohen and Dylan and those sorts of people. It's just not going to happen. I'm sure he's on your list here somewhere.
He is.
Well, maybe we should play him now.
Okay. Under the moniker Smog.
Oh, there is Rock Bottom Riser.
Yep.
Okay, let's hear it. This is Smog, Bill Callahan. Rock Bottom Riser there from Smog. That's Bill Callahan. The choice of Adrian Crowley is with me in studio. I'm not surprised you picked Bill Callahan tonight, but what's interesting, we were just talking about that while it was playing. I'd say when someone hears Bill Callahan for the first time, they think, what's going on here, you know? And yet, that's a pretty straightforward, in one way, song. I mean, the chords and everything is pretty straightforward.
Yeah, musically it is.
Classical ending on it, you know, the classic end.
Exactly.
And yet there's some kind of, what's the word, gravitas that he has, you know?
That's exactly what I would say it has, gravitas. But, you know, musically, say if you were to try and take it apart chord by chord or whatever, the first time I heard that, and many people would probably have thought the same, is that you kind of know what chord is coming next. And then when it does fall the way you expected it to, you're happy it did. And the feeling, just the simplicity, the beauty of the whole song, you feel like it just couldn't have been any other way, and it sounds like it has always existed, you know.
And you said just before we played that, you reckon he is the greatest songwriter.
I know it's a pretty big thing to say, but I've said that a few times to myself. I would say so. Yeah, I think so. Good. Right now, today.
At this moment,
sitting in this chair, I would say yes.
Okay, your next choice is Aldous Harding, who I must say I love Aldous Harding. She's from New Zealand, isn't that right?
Yes, I finally got to see her play live this time last year in Paris, and she put on this incredible show, really bewitching, and I just think she's a very special artist. This is called Imagining My Man.
Aldous Harding there, Imagining My Man, the choice of Adrian Crowley, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. So that kind of, I've used the word aesthetic a couple of times, which I prefer to avoid.
But
I'm just curious, when you hit on this aesthetic that you have of, you know, you're not ABBA, you're not AC/DC, no. you're not blasting stuff out. It's quite the opposite. It's pared down, and it's. I'm not saying you're always going to be this, but yeah. what you've done so far has been pared down, sparse, unshowy.
Yes,
you know, and introspective, and all of those things. Is that just who you are, and it's always going to be that? Or
no. Well, I think what I have is all those things, but I think there's something else too. I feel this kind of real need to communicate, and in the moment, yeah. say for instance a live show, it might be quiet and sparse, mm-hmm. but I suppose I've played so many concerts now, and this thing struck me recently. I was in New York and playing a gig with a bunch of other people. Right before I went on stage, there was someone in a monkey mask doing a performance art piece rolling around on the floor, and I was thinking, how am I going to follow this? You know, because I do sparse, introspective, moody stuff. Mm. And this is in a Manhattan, free gig in Manhattan, you know. But I don't think what I do is non-realistic, if you know what I mean. I'm yes. not like staring at my belly button.
Yeah. It's not shoegaze.
No, I don't think
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
And so much of it is about reaching, maybe putting my hand on someone's shoulder in some way.
Yeah, yeah. And what about, what do you think, or do you think about the performative part of it? And again, I'm thinking of Lou Reed and, you know, that song. His argument, or not his argument, what he would say was, I want everybody to believe every word that I'm saying, even if it's not about me. These songs are, you know, not necessarily, yeah. but I want you to believe every word. And I am literally whispering in your ear.
Absolutely.
Which is different from, you know, obviously the bombastic pop or rock music. It's a different approach. It's an intimate thing.
It is an intimate thing. And also, it's really, when I think about it, it's about empathy to other humans.
Yeah.
And just because a song isn't blatantly autobiographical doesn't mean that you can't wear it, inhabit it and stir something in someone else through it. And I think that's about empathy, you know. And I would hope that's part of what makes me do what I do as well, you know, the empathy.
And in terms of the, you know, the loner aspect or the shy aspect and all of that, yeah, you're not awkwardly shy. It's not that you can't talk to people, but
now I can.
Yeah. But when you start singing songs like that, though, and you're, I mean, I think a lot of people sometimes have a concern about, I think sometimes people are confused because they see performers, actors in particular, doing the most outrageous things. And then they go on talk shows and say how shy they are. And it's hard to equate the thing because most people who think themselves shy think, I could never do that. And yeah. yet you get up and sing these songs. And it must have been at some point a very difficult step to take.
I do remember the very day where I thought, okay, I'm pretty nervous. This is my first gig. I didn't sleep the night before. It felt like right the morning of the first gig, it felt like the worst idea I'd ever had to put myself through this.
Yeah.
And it was almost like, you know, throwing myself into this really scary situation to come out the other side. And without doing it, I just knew I would never, without doing it that first time, I knew I'd never be able to
yeah.
get up on the stage. And there is this kind of, yeah, it doesn't really make sense when you look at it like that. But we have many sides. Sometimes we just don't show them all.
And when you're on stage and you're in the middle of a gig, do you feel, as some performers say, that's the happiest place for me? That's
oh, yeah.
That's where I'm absolutely at my best.
Yeah, I just feel, I feel like that's where I should be at that moment in time, if my monitor mix is just right.
And what do you like after a gig?
After a gig, oh.
I mean, can you talk to people? Do you want to be in a darkened room? Do you want to go out in the town? What happens?
Well, I want to do all those things at the same time, you know? It's very confusing. And if I'm on tour, a lot of the time I'm totally by myself on tour. Only recently I brought along this great person who was the tour manager and driver and buddy. And now I'll never go back. I'll always have someone with me, I think. Mm. But on tour, I'd jump off the stage, then I'll be manning the merch table. And if it's around Europe, there's usually people there waiting to talk to me, or either, if not to purchase a record, they just want to talk. And I love talking to people. And I'm making all these mistakes because, you know, you've just performed, you've just like laid yourself bare, and then you're supposed to do mathematics right afterwards, you know? You know what I mean? It's really difficult. So I'm always making these huge mistakes and leaving money behind and going back the next day to see if I can find this little envelope of merch money.
you need an organization now.
Yeah.
You really do. We're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back after this. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the tracks. And tonight it's Adrian Crowley who's picking all the music for us. And I'm not sure where we left this, Adrian. We were talking about performance and, you know, shyness and the effects, the effects of performance and what it does to you and all of those things.
Yes.
Do you still, however, you know, when you mentioned at the start that you got this actual physical rush when you compose music, when you compose a song, do you still get that?
I do, yeah. If I don't get it in some way, I feel what I have there isn't really right.
Right. So yeah, that's...
It's kind of deceptive as well, because sometimes, it's, you know, writing music, writing songs, if you ask me what is my typical way, I can't really remember. It just happens. And
well, then what kind of a setup do you have then? That might give us some picture. Are you still writing in the bedroom, if you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. There's in the room in my house where I write, the bedroom, I think I must have written about 50 songs in there. And there's something about that room that works for me, you know, and having the instruments close at hand. But I never really know where it comes from or how the next one will come. Although I must say I am kind of like I'm haunted by the sort of like specters of many songs at the same time,
yeah,
all asking me for some attention, and they don't really leave me alone.
So, and do you write on guitar or keyboard or what?
Guitar and piano,
yeah,
and mostly, yeah. And I have a 21st century version of a Mellotron, which I really love. It's like my favorite new toy. And that's really, really handy for kind of getting an atmosphere. Say if I have words of a song coming, but I don't really feel like playing guitar or piano, I'll just maybe paint an atmosphere of sort of like ambient sounds. And then that will affect the way I sing and the way the words come out and the space and everything. So that's very exciting.
How important was it in terms of this process to wind up working with someone like Thomas Bartlett, who produced Dark Eyed Messenger, your last album? Because Thomas is a man who would have all sorts of ideas and so on.
Yes.
And he's worked with great people. I mean, he's done so much great work. You know, in trying to make your product better, which I suppose is a producer's job, you know, to make it as good as it can possibly be, and to bring another imagination into play.
Well, that was an amazing thing to happen, and very fortuitous too. The way we met was we were both involved in this special concert, two concerts in the National Concert Hall, on the reinterpretation of William Butler Yeats' poetry, and we just got on really well, you know. And at the end of the first night, he said to me, "Would you like to make a record sometime?" And I said, "Absolutely." So a few months later, I was over in New York. But the thing is, it was so fresh for me. It was very refreshing that he had these strong ideas about how he thought maybe he could present my songs in a way that they hadn't been presented before. And I'm not very precious about instrumentation, you know. I'm precious about the music and the words, but it doesn't necessarily have to have, say, a guitar. So the first suggestion he came to me with was to drop the guitar entirely, and he was really amazed when I said, yeah, no problem. But I always wanted to make a record with no guitar. And for some, that sounded pretty drastic, but as an idea. But to me, no. But it was very important for me to click with him the way I did. And we will do more work together, I think, you know.
And what sort of a presence is Thomas in the studio? Now, I mean, I know Thomas. He's been on this program, and a lot of people listening will know him from the Gloaming and all that. But I've never worked with him in that context, and I'm just curious what sort of a dynamic he has in a studio. I can't imagine him shouting and roaring. That's
not
for sure.
At all. He mostly smiles and giggles.
Yeah,
and it's like being invited into someone's bedroom, and you know, it's a little small workspace he has with a big high window with his pianos around and one microphone in the middle of the room, and it's just so easygoing, and he's got his piano there. He'd ask me, what song would you like to do next? And he'd play it on the piano and I sing along, and then he kind of would say, should we go for a take? Yeah, absolutely. And it was just so easy, yeah. You know, single takes for everything. Then the whole record was done in 4 days, five days. So I didn't feel like I was under pressure. It was very much like being in someone's flat, having fun.
And how did you react then to your own music, you know, being represented in this way?
Well, it made me very proud, because all the thought that I had put into the arrangements and writing in the demos, all those little things, all those ornaments, all the spaces, the unusual shifts that the music had in the demos, they were all kept the exact same way in the reinterpretation that Thomas brought to it. So I felt proud that these rough recordings were like blueprints, but then also proud that someone like Thomas was moved by it and moved by what I do and was willing to just kind of let himself fall into the music, you know?
I think we should probably play something else from the album that I haven't just talked about. What about Valley of Tears? I always like that one.
Sure.
Valley of Tears, Adrian Crowley from Dark Eyed Messenger. And Adrian's with me in studio tonight picking all the tracks. Now, this next track you're going to pick, Adrian, is it'll need a bit of introduction, because it is 1 hour, 4 minutes and 11 seconds long. So
yes,
unless we decide to really go rogue, we can't really do that.
Yeah.
So David Sylvian.
Well, this album, it seemed to have just come out without me knowing about it till a couple of years later. And it's in collaboration with an American poet called Franz Wright, who passed away 3 years ago. And so it's this long, rambling, beautiful creature of a thing, very moving. It's full of humor. There's a sense of mortality in the voice of the narrator. And very uncommercial, I suppose.
And who narrates this? Is it Sylvian himself, or
Franz Wright?
It's the poet himself. Yeah. Okay.
So, but it came out as a David Sylvian album. But it's hard to figure where one character stops and the other starts in terms of the contributors. I think it's astonishing. It's very cinematic. It's poetry. It's beautiful music, and it's beautifully human.
Okay, well, we're not going to play an hour and 4 minutes of it, but we'll play part of "There Is a Light That Enters Houses with No Other Houses in Sight." Music there from David Sylvian, the words of Franz Wright, poet, taken from a very long piece of music called "There Is a Light That Enters Houses with No Other Houses in Sight," the choice of Adrian Crowley, who's with me in studio tonight. This gorgeous stuff. I'm going to get that.
Yes, I love it.
Listen to the full 1 hour of it. And David Sylvian, of course, people will know in Japan way back. One of the first singles I ever got my hands on was Ghosts, which is an extraordinary record. Now, that sort of... I'm trying to figure out what kind of music you listen to nowadays. Are you quite... Well, let me put it this way. Do you stray from your own aesthetic very much? For instance, if I was in your house, you know, some evening, would you be playing, I don't know, ABBA? Would you be playing? You would be, yeah. Would you be playing? You know what I mean. You're not just going to hear, Bill Callahan.
No, not at all. Also, I mean, say for instance, if I've been working on writing all day, or recording, or touring, or something, at the end of the day, I want something totally different.
Sure. Do you listen to jazz? Do you listen to hip-hop? Do you listen to classical? Do you listen to...
Actually, my son is into hip-hop, and I listen to it through him, which is a very new experience for me. You know, discovering through your own child is great.
And are you the kind of parent who would say, turn that racket off?
No way.
Let me hear this.
Yeah, so...
No, I like the way you responded to that. No way.
Yeah,
it is the worst. You know, it's the worst crime. You can't tell your kids to turn off their music.
No,
unless it's really bad.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I like to think he has great taste. My son and my daughter. My son, he's the older one, so he's more of a music listener. Plays Illan pipes too, so he's got this. He brought trad into my house.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
You see, I've met a surprisingly high number of artists who don't actually listen outside their own orbit. And in fact, some of them don't seem particularly interested in anything else apart from what they do themselves. And maybe that's what it takes in some cases for some people to make their work, you know. But I know, you know, novelists who don't seem to read other people and songwriters who've never even gone back and checked out the legends, you know. It's kind of an odd thing.
In a way, I think I'm like that. Sometimes I don't want to listen too much to something that I worry that I might even like too much.
Yeah.
I know that sounds ridiculous, but...
I suppose you've got to protect what you do yourself as well, you know, protect your own...
Yeah, because it is a light that's trying to, you know, glow. And it is, like I said earlier, it's a mysterious light and you don't want to cover it up.
Okay, we're getting into murky territory. your next choice is... Well, Quiet Life. What do you fancy?
Quiet Life, yeah. How about that?
Okay, so tell me, you've got Blixa Bargeld here and... tell me about Teo Teardo, because somebody else... I may not even pronouncing the name correctly, but...
Yeah, I think it's Theo or Theo. I don't know.
Teardo. Someone else recently sent me a link on Spotify to music by this particular person. So what can you tell me there? What do you know about...
I know very little about him, actually, Theo. But he composes a lot for film, and I do know that he had something to do with an Irish production recently.
That makes sense to me now.
And I think Cillian Murphy was involved in it.
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Blixa, I love his voice. You know, he was in the Bad Seeds with Nick Cave for a long time, one of the early members, and also the famous... semi-industrial Berlin band with a very long name in German.
Einster Neubatten.
That's the one. Demolishing new
it's
buildings.
The one reason I don't play them on the radio is I can't say their name.
So, well, Blixa.
They've got a great track called Silence is Sexy. Do you know that one?
Oh, yeah, I do know
That's
it.
That's an amazing
yeah.
piece of music.
Yeah.
But only I can't pronounce their name, I would play it on the radio.
I think it's Einstürzende Neubatten.
Einstürzende Neubatten.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So
anyway, this isn't them.
No, well, Blixa was in that band.
Here's Blixa.
And
Theo Teardo, we reckon. And that's Colleen, the choice of Adrian Crowley, who's with me in studio. That Colleen track is called... There's a couple of Colleens out there in the world, but that particular one is on the Leaf record label. And the Golden Morning breaks from an album called The Golden Morning Breaks. And before that, we had Blixa Bargeld and a track called A Quiet Life. Really good, wasn't it?
Yeah, I love that
really
one.
Really good. Thanks for those. There's a couple of things I want to ask you about. You did a bit of acting.
That's true.
you're still at the acting, Crowley. No, you did a bit of acting, which again seems like, you know, having set yourself up as a shy and introspective person, here we are at the acting. So what happened there?
Well, actually, right after I dropped out of college, I went and hired a darkroom where I worked for a year taking pictures, making pictures. And at that time, I hadn't played any gigs, by the way, at this stage. I joined the Focus Theatre with Deirdre O'Connell.
Yeah.
And she took me under her wing. She had plans for me, you know, and I worked hard and I loved it. And then...
Now, the Focus, if people don't know it, tiny little theatre.
Yeah.
Baggett Street somewhere, was it somewhere in there?
Just around the corner from Fitzwilliam Square.
The name of the street, yes.
Yeah.
And I was in it a few times, but was that... Was it that method, what do you call it?
Yeah, the Stanislavski studio. Method. Yeah, that's it. It was so intense. I got the shakes, actually.
Yeah.
But sometimes I wondered, was it because I was scared of Deirdre? No, I'm joking. I got the shakes many times in there.
So what does the Stanislavski method put you through?
Some people kind of crumble and they end up crying and rolling around and not sure how to pull themselves back together afterwards.
Is it method acting?
It is. It's method acting, yeah. in a real kind of pure way. It's sort of like Elemental in a sense. The typical studio, that's what we would call it, the class. You'd have to, if Deirdre allowed you to come in, it was to watch. You'd have to watch, mm-hmm. observe is the word she used, mm-hmm. for minimum 3 months. You'd go every week as if you were going to your class, but you would have to just sit down and watch, observe. And eventually she would point at you and then point at the stage, and then you'd just have to get up on stage and start improvising. A terrifying idea, I think, mm-hmm. but amazing. So I did that with her for, I think it was 2 years. And... then I went to live in France, and I started playing gigs.
So you were thinking of being an actor then? Yes. You must have been quite serious about it to put yourself through all that.
Yeah, I was. I just decided one day I would have to do one or the other. But now I think I can probably try and do both. Mm. I wouldn't mind it. I was involved in a film just this year. It was finished, a feature film. It's sort of a docudrama, so it kind of falls between two disciplines of mm-hmm. filmmaking. But there's a lot of drama in it and a lot of acting. It's called The Science of Ghosts. So I got a taste for it again.
Mm. And did you find that experience fed into the songwriting in any way, or has it contributed in any way to the other part of your life?
I don't know, but maybe it fed into some of the performance, where I would be able to go into a state of not really caring about being in front of people. You know what I mean?
Your next choice, Cathal Kinnick, who I used to know quite well, and she's now living abroad and I haven't seen her in a long time.
Oh, yeah. She's a close friend. She lives in Cardiff now. And this song was the first song I heard of hers before years before we ever became friends. I never really knew I'd ever meet her, you know. And I was bowled over, absolutely bowled over. And
I remember when she was performing, well, I don't know how many years ago it is now, but there was nobody else like her. She was absolutely unique in what she was doing.
Yeah.
This is from an album which I like too called Jet. Which song do you want?
There You Go.
Okay, Cathal Kinnick.
There you go.
Cathal Kinnick, There You Go, from the album Jet, which is the choice of Adrian Crowley, who's my guest on Mystery Train tonight, picking all the music. What about the writing, the written word? Now, before you go, are you going to do something in that direction, do you think?
I hope so. I put a lot of time into it. I've stack of manuscripts that keep shifting around.
Now, are these poems, stories, novels? What are they?
I wish I knew. That's one reason why it's taken me so long. I think there are a few things mixed together. I think I might be a little bit hung up on what it should be. You know what I mean? Mm. There's a lot of alternative novels around that incorporate lyrics.
Alternative novels usually just means that it's not really a novel.
Yeah. Maybe that's all I need to tell myself. Yeah. So.
But well, good luck if you get into that swim.
Thanks. tell you what I need, though.
That's all I can say.
I just need someone to come to my house, clear up my desk, take all those pages away.
I know.
And then come back to me and say, there's your book.
Feed them into a machine and out it comes the other end. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought laptops were supposed to do that for you. Can you get an app for that?
We'll see.
I would have thought. So, well, good luck with all that. The album, I suppose, it'll be a while before there'll be another one because...
Hopefully not too long things, now. Yeah. I'm ready. I've written enough for two, I'd say, so... I'm going to wait, though, a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then record it, hopefully, in a short space of time, sometime in 2019.
Very good. Well, tell me about your last choice, The Black Crow.
Okay, well...
Big song.
This song is written by this amazing performer who's no longer with us, Jason Molina, who went under the name Song Zahaya. He passed away... 5 years ago, and I got to know him quite well, and it's difficult for me actually thinking that he's no longer around. But there was this beautiful tribute to him recently. A book has come out about his life, and his band have gone on a tour of America and Europe singing his songs. And recently they came to play in the Tivoli, and they asked me to come and sing two of his songs. And I'd been ill for a week and I'd lost my voice. So I had to change. I had to sing this next song I did a version of, but an octave, maybe two octaves lower than the recording. I'm not sure how it sounded, but anyway, what a brilliant artist. He left us with some incredible songs and this is one of them.
Adrian, thanks a million for coming in tonight. Thanks for picking all these tracks. You brought some new music into the mix. I'm always grateful for that. So thanks a million.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Thanks,
John.
Adrian.
Thank you.
And we'll see you down the road. Thanks, Adrian. This is The Black Crow, Jason Molina, Songs Ohio.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.